Ukraine's president on why he won't back down in the battle for Bakhmut.
He will sell this victory. He will sell this victory to West, to his society, to China, to Iran, to all the countries.
Plus, as Russia prepares to move tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, Ukraine's other neighbors express concern.
Despite the fact the odds of nuclear war may be low, they're far higher than they should be.
And later in the program, how Bakhmut salt has become a rallying cry for Ukraine manufacturing. Today is Wednesday, March 29th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London in Washington. As Ukrainian forces prepare for a spring offensive and continue the intense fight to hold on to the key city of Bakhmut, Ukraine's president is marking a significant milestone since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, now in its second year. I talked about it with Anna Chernikova, reporting for VOA from Kyiv.
Ukraine is celebrating one victory of sorts, the one-year anniversary of the liberation of the Kyiv region. How significant is this?
It was this period, end of March, when Ukrainian forces managed to take over the control of the areas that Russian forces were occupying and were controlling, and from where Russian forces were trying to continue their assault on the capital. And President Zelensky posted some photos from that period last year, mentioning that today is basically the day one year ago when the whole world saw this horrible image of the result of this occupation. And as we all remember, of course, the image from Bucha that shocked the world and shocked journalists who came there and who were experiencing this. So today is a certain milestone for Ukrainian successful actions in the central part of the country and north part of the country, because this is the period when this counteroffensive began and Kyiv region as well as north part of the country was liberated from Russian occupation.
And of course, now the focus is heavily on this upcoming spring counteroffensive. What do you know about the preparations for that?
We are hearing about this almost every day. Some different officials, not only Ukrainians, are mentioning that actually Ukraine is getting ready. Ukrainian armed forces are getting ready to this big assault, big counteroffensive, and military supplies from the allies is what will help Ukrainians, supposed to help Ukrainian forces to conduct this counteroffensive and to get ready for it. And today we have a little more details from the Minister of Defense of Ukraine. He said that basically Ukrainian general staff is planning this counteroffensive in different directions, and weather would play a big role. So Ukrainian forces are waiting for better conditions, particularly weather conditions, and of course particular conditions in terms of all the military supplies that Ukraine is expecting. And he said that apparently answering the question when this counteroffensive should start or is planning to start, he said that we should expect something like April or May. So this period, end of spring, apparently should be kind of the point of this counteroffensive to begin. But again, we will see what will happen, because of course we cannot independently verify this information.
And there are also major concerns over Russia's threats of tactical nuclear weapons, positioning those weapons potentially in neighboring Belarus. And I know that there's been a visit by the International Atomic Energy Agency to the nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia. Are they feeling still very concerned about the safety of that power plant?
First of all, this is the biggest nuclear power plant in Europe and in Ukraine, but not only in Ukraine, but in the whole European region. And currently, this nuclear power plant is under Russian control. So we don't have yet details of Mr. Gross's visit to the power plant. He did not give any comments. He did not give any statements. But yesterday, he met with President Zelensky. They were visiting another nuclear power plant in the Dnipropetrovsk region of Ukraine, and they had certain conversation about, in general, about the atomic safety, because the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant remains under Russian control, and it's difficult to really judge on what's happening inside. But there are a lot of risks, and we've heard previous reports by the Atomic Energy Agency about certain concerns from the side. Of course, we will be waiting for Mr. Grossi's statement after his visit. But with President Zelensky, what we know that with President Zelensky, they discussed this particular case and in general nuclear safety. And President Zelensky made a very clear statement that he basically requires immediate withdrawal of Russian forces from the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant and demilitarization of this area. Because, of course, this plant is located in the city of Enerhodar, which is the Zaporizhzhia region, and it is currently under very high risk of shelling.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in an interview with the Associated Press, stressed the importance of the fight for the eastern city of Bakhmut.
He will sell this victory. He will sell this victory to West, to his society, to China, to Iran, to all the countries, to Brazil, to Latin America countries, not to Latvia, Litva, Estonia. Of course, they really understand, you know, from details, and they feel this dangerous because they are their neighbors. So, but he will sell it to his society. What, that was the first step. Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I will have decision with Ukraine. Then another step, another step, another step.
And following Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent visit to Russia, Zelensky expressed his own hopes that Xi would travel to Ukraine.
Of course, I gave all the diplomatic and public and not public to President of China, to leader of China, and I want to speak with him. Because I had contact with him before full-scale war, but during all this year, more than 1 year, I didn't have, and I really wait when our teams will find
like
the solution.
To, but no plans
yes.
at the moment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Would you invite him here to Ukraine?
Oh yes, we are ready. We are ready to see him here.
As the United States co-hosts the second summit for democracy, Russian President Vladimir Putin has announced plans to station tactical nuclear weapons in Belarus. Latvia's Foreign Minister Edgars Rinkevičs was in Washington on Wednesday, and in an exclusive interview with VOA's Georgian service, Rinkevičs expressed his support for Ukraine, concerns about Russian nuclear threats, and for Latvia's borders.
The main topics we are discussing with all the people I'm meeting here is about Russia's aggression against Ukraine and how to better help Ukraine. I think that we are in the year that is very decisive, and of course our position is that we must provide Ukraine with all weapons, ammunition they are asking for. Then of course it's about sanctions against Russia and Belarus, because we believe that we need to do more also when it comes to sanctioning Belarus, especially after the announcement by Mr. Putin that there will be more tactical weapons near our borders.
Listen to Flashpoint Ukraine on Thursday for VOA Georgian Service's full interview with Latvia's Foreign Minister Edgars Rinkevičs. As we mentioned, the U.S. State Department is hosting the second Summit for Democracy this week, including 120 countries, civil society groups, and technological companies. The mostly virtual summit includes some countries that have been criticized recently for undemocratic policies. The summit started with a focus on Ukraine and the role of women in democracy. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent, Cindy Sain, reports.
A Ukrainian unit fires a French-made howitzer toward the Russian lines in the eastern Donetsk region as Ukraine continues to try to repel Russia's invasion. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmitry Kuleba spoke remotely Tuesday to the U.S.-organized Democracy Summit, saying the Ukrainian people want peace more than anyone, but peace at any cost is an illusion.
The Ukrainian people will accept peace only if it guarantees the cessation of Russian aggression in full, the complete withdrawal of Russian troops from Ukrainian territory, and the restoration of our state's territorial integrity within internationally recognized borders.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken opened a panel discussion of the Democracy Summit Tuesday, saying nothing illustrates the threat to democracies from dictatorships better than Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. Blinken embraced Ukraine's peace proposal and rejected others, such as China's, without naming names.
I think we all have to be very much aware and beware of what may seem to be well-intentioned efforts, for example, to call for ceasefires, which would potentially have the effect of freezing in place the conflict, allowing Russia to consolidate the gains that it's made, and simply use the time to rest and refit and then re-attack.
One expert told VOA that President Joe Biden's second democracy summit faces several challenges, including tensions with close U.S. allies such as Israel. But he said winning support for Ukraine is a major focus of the summit. Michael Kimmage is a history professor at Catholic University. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
You have dramatic events in Israel that go to the core of what Israel is as a democracy. You have backsliding among various European countries. It's kind of an old story. But I think the core problem for President Biden is that you have a lot of democracies, South Africa, Brazil, and India, for example, that are not especially supportive of the U.S. position on the war in Ukraine.
Kimmage told VOA that despite the challenges, the achievements on the battlefield under the leadership of Ukraine's democratically elected president, Volodymyr Zelensky, against what is on paper a superior Russian military, is an inspiration and could be a galvanizing force for democracy around the world. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A senior Russian diplomat said Wednesday that Moscow will no longer inform the U.S. about its missile tests, an announcement that came as Russia's military deployed mobile launchers in Siberia in a show of the country's massive nuclear capability. With growing concerns over Russia's nuclear threats, VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports on how the weapons that Russia has used so far in its war on Ukraine have already taken a heavy toll, not only on the civilian population in Ukraine, but also on that country's environment.
Anti-war protesters rallied in Washington. They demanded a peaceful resolution to the war in Ukraine and a shift in gears regarding U.S. support to Kyiv. Ben Becker with the Answer Coalition was among the organizers.
We know people are hurting right now from inflation. The war economy is also starving. Instead, there's billions and billions of dollars that are being drained into the war economy.
Some demonstrators had nuclear concerns. John, who only gave VOA his first name, said,
despite the fact the odds of nuclear war may be low, they're far higher than they should be.
A new Axios Ipsos poll shows that 79% of Americans who identify as Democrats and 60% who identify as independents still support sending weapons and money to Ukraine, but only 42% of Republicans surveyed do. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis made his stance clear last week in a written statement read by Fox News anchor Tucker Carlson.
We cannot prioritize intervention in an escalating foreign war over the defense of our own homeland.
Former Vice President Mike Pence refuted DeSantis' stance on ABC's This Week.
And as the leader of the free world, as the arsenal of democracy, America needs to continue to ensure that the Ukrainian military has what they need.
Both Pence and DeSantis are considering entering the 2024 presidential race, but neither has officially declared their candidacy. Solidarity with Kyiv is still strong among the American public. However, some divisions among Democrats who favor negotiations with Russia are also starting to surface, noted Stephen Smith, professor of political science at Iowa State University, who spoke with VOA via Skype.
Liberals and progressives in the Democratic Party are not very happy with the Biden administration. And if President Biden decides to run for re-election, which I think he will, there's going to be pressure to probably re-examine and revisit the American policy to Ukraine.
Splits among both parties could deepen, he added, as other critically important policy decisions arise that may compete with Ukraine for attention.
One is the banking situation, which is very serious, and the Chinese activities in regard to Taiwan and to the Pacific, where China has been very aggressively expanding its influence.
Schmidt expects the big debate on the U.S. support for Ukraine will unfold early next year as the 2024 presidential race heats up. Veronica Valeras Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. In response to reports of military actions against civilians during Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the Pilecki Institute in Warsaw, Poland, has established a center that collects and preserves evidence of potential war crimes and crimes against humanity. Lizia Bakalets has the story from Warsaw.
Destruction of civilian infrastructure, looting, violence, kidnapping, and murder. The Rafael Lemkin Center for Documenting Russian Crimes in Ukraine seeks evidence of these violations. The center was established by the Warsaw-based Pilecki Institute, a research institution dedicated in part to studying totalitarian regimes.
We are collecting eyewitness accounts from civilians about war crimes and other crimes committed by the Russian Federation in Ukraine.
Created immediately after the start of the full-scale invasion, the center was named after the Jewish lawyer who introduced and defined the term genocide, meaning the destruction of a nation or ethnic group. Russia denies committing war crimes. Here, a dozen specialists read and process the testimonies of Ukrainians.
We are working on the questionnaire, which was created specifically for this project by scientists, historians, lawyers, based on the principles of international law, and also psychologists.
The specialists usually look for potential witnesses in refugee camps. A group also works in Ukraine. Persuading a person to talk is the biggest challenge, says Katerina Sukhomlinova, a Lemkin Center coordinator.
I start my communication by addressing people. I say, good afternoon. If you are witnesses or victims, went through the occupation, filtration camps, or were witnesses of other crimes, talk to us.
Sukhomlinova is also a refugee. She spent 21 days in occupied Mariupol. She agreed to testify for the Lemkin Center when she fled to Poland.
Unfortunately, I saw enough in 21 days in Mariupol. And now my vocation is to be a kind of Mariupol ambassador to bring the truth to the world. I'm often called to help people from Mariupol testify because I know a little, just a little, about how they feel.
It can take several hours to fill out the questionnaire. Some witnesses find it convenient to write. Some prefer to speak on the record. Each person is guaranteed anonymity. But even with this condition, the testimony can be used in legal arguments.
The one condition is very basic, that the testimony should come from eyewitness. This is very important. But because of we have a full personal data, it's also possible to just call the people once again before the prosecutors.
Also, the testimonies can be used to search for missing persons.
It may happen that in a few years, some victims' families will look for what happened to their relatives, and they will find information about it precisely in our archive.
The center has already collected 800 questionnaires from Ukrainians from multiple regions that have seen Russian attacks. People are most willing to talk about the destruction of infrastructure and least willing to talk about rape. Time, they say, at the Lemkin Center plays against the witnesses. The further away they are from the tragic events, the harder they find it to recall them. Lesia Bakalets, VOA News, Warsaw.
Feel the force. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma
tells us how actor Mark Hamill carries his Star Wars voice to Ukraine.
Attention, air raid alert. Proceed to the nearest shelter. Don't be careless. Your overconfidence is your weakness.
It's a surreal moment in an already surreal war. The grave but calming baritone of actor Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker of Star Wars, urging people to take cover whenever Russia unleashes another aerial bombardment on Ukraine. The intrusion of Hollywood science fiction fantasy into the grim daily realities of war in Ukraine is a consequence of Hamill's decision to lend his famous voice to Air Alert, a downloadable app linked to Ukraine's air defense system. When air raid sirens start howling, the app also warns Ukrainians that Russian missiles, bombs, and deadly exploding drones may be incoming.
Attention! The air alert is over. May the force be with you.
I'm Charles Tuladesma.
The contested Bakhmut region in Ukraine has been putting salt on the tables of most Ukrainians and many European countries for more than 140 years. Today, the manufacturing facilities in the region are practically destroyed. But Bakhmut salt has become a rallying cry. Hanna Tervdoklib has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
For weeks, Russia has been attempting to push Ukrainian forces from areas in and around the city of Bakhmut. Moscow wants to occupy the Bakhmut region because it sees its defeat as a step to capturing the entire Donbas region. The town of Soledar, 18 kilometers from Bakhmut, has also been in Russia's crosshairs and is known for its massive salt mines. For Ukrainians, rock salt is linked to one of the most recognizable symbols of the country. The product is synonymous with Ukraine and has not changed for decades. But today, amid the war, the packaging is also a canvas for artist Alexander Vojtovich.
I've always associated salt with Ukraine. I would use the concept. After the war started, it all acquired new meanings.
Before the war, Artem Sil, the state-owned industrial association for salt production, produced 90% of Ukraine's rock salt and exported it to 15 other countries. Salt production started in Soledar in 1881. In April 2022, it halted because of constant shelling of the plant by Russian forces. Some 2,500 employees were left without a job. Ukraine was left without salt. While the salt was still available, Vojtovich drew pictures on the packs. One of his creations has already made its way to a Washington museum.
It's a humble material, but a material that I think most ordinary Ukrainians might have in their homes. I lived in Ukraine for 3 years and I had this box of salt.
Vojtovich has been drawn to this unusual canvas since his student years.
I was studying in the Academy of the Arts in the early 90s, and we had a shortage of everything, including paper. And students who needed to draw were on the lookout for any handy material. We experimented with charcoal as well.
To mark the end of the first year of the war, the last boxes of Artem Sil sold were recently packaged and sold under the name of Solidarity, Ukrainian Rock Solid Strength. All proceeds go to help buy drones for the Ukrainian military. For Hanna Tvertakhlib in Washington, NRI's BOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.